So today I'll continue to recount some of the stories that occur in the suttas, the ancient discourses, texts that contain the teachings of the Buddha. And one of the reasons for these stories is that the stories often contextualize the teachings, or the stories highlight what's important about the teachings, and or illustrate them in some way. And so today's story comes from the second discourse in the anthology called The Long Discourses of the Buddha. And it's called long because these discourses, these texts, are relatively long compared to many of the others in other anthologies. And so the second one, and it's generally called in English something like the fruits of the renunciant life, or the fruits of the reclusive life. Or the it's a samanya pala. Pala means fruit. Samanya means someone who's a recluse or a contemplative or a renunciant. Maybe it's a little bit like in the old days in English, we would talk about someone who's a religious. And a religious person, a religious, generally meant someone who's kind of dedicated themselves to a life of the religious life. And so this is someone in ancient India who dedicated themselves to a lifestyle of full-time dedication to the religious life of the times. And so it involves and this particular discourse, I think of it as being like an opera, operatic, and it's and some of it is this huge pathos, a display of, you know, that involves a kind of a operatic kind of suffering that kind of is a context for the teachings. So maybe, I don't know if I can describe the scene to be kind of, but as grand like an opera, but it begins with the greatest king of India at the time of the Buddha, a king by the name of Ajatasattu. And the king was a full moon night, beautiful full moon night with a clear sky. And the king was on the high terrace on his palace, looking out across the scene above the treetops, the full moon, and the beautiful light and clarity. And he's there with his ministers. And he's exclaiming, how beautiful, how wonderful the night is, the full moon. It's wonderful to see. And then he asks his ministers, who can I go visit? What spiritual teacher can I go visit? Spiritual teachers often gathered on the full moon with their disciples, so it was kind of a time to remember the spiritual life, perhaps. And so he said, who can I go visit who might bring peace to my distressed heart? And the reason the king's heart is distressed, and we get a sense that it comes up at the end of this discourse, we understand why, is that he became king by killing his own father. And this was troubling him. And so he wanted to go find someone who could kind of settle or calm his troubled heart. And so the ministers, six ministers, each of them suggested that he go see a particular religious teacher of the time. And each of them, the king said, no, no, I visited before, and what the person said didn't help. But this a seventh minister didn't say anything, just was silent. And then the king at some point turned to that seventh minister, Jivaka. I think he was the king's, that minister, but maybe the king's doctor. And said, Jivaka, you're not saying anything. Do you have a suggestion of who I might visit? And Jivaka says, well, in fact, there is a religious teacher who's in town, nearby, in the woods, who has a really good report. Is said to be not only a wonderful teacher for other people, but a wonderful teacher for the gods. And the word God can, in ancient India, also meant king. So it's a either it was so wonderful that he's good for the gods, but also so wonderful he's good for the kings. And you know, Ajatasattu was the king. And hearing this wonderful report about the Buddha, I guess he had never seen the Buddha, said, "Let's go." And so they assemble a grand pageant. You assemble 500 elephants. Maybe it's a little bit like the Bradley tanks of modern world. These ancient, the king would have all these war elephants, maybe, but 500 of them were assembled for this, going into the woods to see the Buddha. And on these 500 was the king and his 500 wives. And this represents maybe the setting up a contrast between the largeness, the power, the wealth of this great king, and then his great involvement with sensual pleasures, which later you can see that's one of his primary occupations. And they march into the forest to go see the Buddha in the full moon night. And as they get into the dark forest, the king gets really frightened, and his hair stands up on end, and he says to Jivaka, "Jivaka, are you taking us into the forest so my enemies can ambush me? Is this a trick?" And Jivaka reassures him, no, it's not a trick. But it's so quiet here, and you told me there are 1,250 monks with the Buddha, and I don't hear a peep from any of them. Ah, that's because these Buddhist monks are really well-behaved and quiet. They're sitting listening to the Buddha. So Ajatasattu gets off his elephant and does the final distance to where the Buddha is sitting by foot. But he says, Jivaka, where is the Buddha? I don't see him anywhere. And suggesting that the Jivaka is in the assembly with the other monks, but he doesn't recognize the Buddha. But then Jivaka says, the Buddha is up against that central pillar facing all the monks. So the king goes up to the Buddha and offers his greetings. And then the Buddha kind of picks up something. And he says, Ajatasattu, king, are you thinking of the people you love? And the king says, yes, I'm thinking about my young son. I wish he could be this calm and settled as these monks, 1,250 monks are sitting here so peacefully and quietly listening to you. I wish my son could be this calm and quiet. And that's all he says about his son. But the audience who's watching this opera or listening to the story, they know that the king killed his own father to become king. And they probably, because this was told, story was told for centuries after the Buddha died, the audience knows that Ajatasattu's son later then killed Ajatasattu to become king. So this patricide continued. So there's this pathos that's kind of in the air around the sutta. And then Ajatasattu asks the Buddha, what is the fruit of the renunciant life? What's the benefit of becoming a monastic and practicing the religious life? And the Buddha says, have you asked anyone else that? And he says, yes, I asked the six other spiritual teachers, but I wasn't satisfied with their answers. And the Buddha said, well, tell me. And one of them teaching was, there is no such thing as evil or badness or demerit, and you can just do whatever you want and you won't do any evil. Someone else said that there doesn't exist really, people don't exist, they're empty, they don't really exist, and if you chop someone's head off, it doesn't really, you're not killing anyone because people don't exist. Someone else said that the amount of suffering and pain that you have and joy you have is allocated when you're first born, and you just have to kind of just play it all out, and it's all predetermined, and so nothing you can do makes any difference. Someone else said that they didn't know anything. They didn't know. They simply didn't know if there was any benefit or fruit of the practice, and so had no answer to give. And someone else, so they went on, these teachings. And all the teachings, you can kind of feel as these teachings are recounted, that for someone who killed their own father, none of them really settled the heart. None of them really touched him or worked for him. So he came to the Buddha, and he asked the Buddha then the same question. So then the Buddha said, he answered indirectly by asking a question of the king. The Buddha often did that rather than answering directly. He said, "Dear king, if you have a slave," so here's the most powerful person in the world at the time, and the Buddha's talking about one of the most, had least power, a slave. "And your slave decides that there's another way of living and wants to do good in the world, wants to acquire merit, and not just kind of do this grunge work for the king on and on for the whole life. And so the slave goes off to become a monastic, ordains, becomes a renunciant, lives a holy life. What would you do? Would you insist on the slave coming back and being a slave?" And the king said, no, if they were really living a renunciant life and a good life, then I would honor that person and I would bring them gifts and food and robes and support them. And the Buddha said, well, is this one of the fruits of the holy life, of the renunciant life? And the king said, oh yes, this would be one of the fruits if you lived that life, freed from slavery. And then the king said, well, tell me something more. And the king and the Buddha said, well, if someone was one of your workers, like a minister or something, and they left your employment to become monastic, what would you do then? Oh, I would honor them and give them gifts and support them and protect them. This too is a fruit of the renunciant life. And then Ajatasattu said, well, tell me, is there any other fruits of the holy life? So the third time the king asks, the Buddha then gives some of his own teachings. And there's an ancient tradition that you don't really teach someone until they ask three times. So then Ajatasattu says, well, as a person hears the teachings from the Buddha or some person like that and becomes a monastic, a renunciant. And then they engage in the spiritual life. And as they engage in the spiritual life, the Buddha describes how all the what's called the gradual path of practice, the practice of morality, of cultivation, of concentration, to all the way to awakening. And there's all these steps that are described, but many of the steps result in happiness and bliss and gladness and joy. And so the whole practice, once we get into the world of practice, of living an ethical life, there's the bliss of blamelessness. There's contentment. As we practice meditation and the hindrances abate, there's gladness that we're no longer enslaved by these powerful mind states. And as we enter into the jhanas, there's all this deep joy and happiness and tranquility of the jhanas that comes along. So the Buddha is describing this wonderful gradual path where there's all this benefit, this fruit and joy and happiness and well-being that comes along, all the way up to awakening. And when the king hears all this, he says, wow, yes, this is the fruit of the homeless life. I'm so inspired. From now on, I go for refuge to the Buddha. Let the Buddha be my teacher. And the Buddha kind of nods in assent. And then Ajatasattu has heard his great teaching and so inspired, he says something, well, I have a lot to do. The king has a lot of work to do and a lot of sensual pleasures to attend to. So I have to go back to my job. And something like that. Then. So the king says, oh, do as you wish. And then the king goes off. And the Buddha is left, and he tells his other his monks who are there, and monks and nuns, that if the king had not killed his father, in hearing this discourse, he would have attained the first stage of awakening. His Dharma eye would have opened. But with this heavy, harm that he caused, the fruit of that, the consequence of that, is that, he didn't say this literally, but kind of my interpretation of it, the consequence of that is that his heart is closed to the liberative effect of these teachings. And so that's a fruit of causing harm in this world. That your heart is much more closed. Is it permanently closed or not? We don't know. my teacher in Burma gave lots of stories to me of people he'd known who, not that they killed their parents, but soldiers who had killed people, and the struggles they had to open up their heart, but they always succeeded to do it through the teachings and to be changed. So this contrast between the king and the consequence of his actions and the choice of a monastic and the consequence of their actions, their practice, and what arises, what's welcomed, what's received, the fruit that comes from the spiritual life is the theme of this operatic sutta. So so that's the story for today, and we'll continue tomorrow. Thank you.